I'm sitting on the balcony reading Flannery O'Connor.
These two have shed their fine feathers. These two have slimed their dark, bright coats. These two have condescended to dig in. The white-tailed eagle at the battle ebb, where the sea wars against the river, the speckled kite of Maldon and the crow have naturally selected to be unwinged.
There it comes around again.
Hello, Kate.
Hi, Antonia.
We're here again.
Here we are. Nice to be back.
Yeah, what are we doing this week?
Well, we're doing David Jones Mark II, which is very exciting. We've been given granted a second episode by ourselves.
Mm. Mainly because last time we chatted about a lot of in parentheses, which we never read to you. So
yes.
We're going to do a little bit of the reading from that, from part three of that.
So that's Jane Jones's first major poetic work. And then our sort of liturgical touch point is Laetare Sunday. And we're going to read a bit from Ephesians, from the Mass for Laetare Sunday. And then we thought we would pick up on Bunches of Flowers, which we didn't do last time. And maybe I can connect that to Jones, because Jones is also interested in the significance of Bunches of Flowers.
I'm glad you're going to find some way of connecting it, because from reading the passage that we're going to read from in parentheses, I didn't think that it really, you know, sprung out as, wow, this is so much related to Bunches of Flowers.
No, because the excerpt we're going to read is set in a flowerless battlefield. So pretty, yeah. Although there are plenty of references to flowers in parentheses itself. So I'll come to that later.
Good. Should we go straight in with the reading from the Ephesians?
Let's do that.
A reading from St. Paul to the Ephesians. God loved us with so much love that he was generous with his mercy. When we were dead through our sins, he brought us to life with Christ. It is through grace that you have been saved and raised us up with him and gave us a place with him in heaven in Christ Jesus. This was to show for all ages to come, through his goodness towards us in Christ Jesus, how infinitely rich he is in grace, because it is by grace that you have been saved, through faith, not by anything of your own, but by a gift from God. Not by anything that you have done, so that nobody can claim the credit. We are God's work of art, created in Christ Jesus to live the good life, as from the beginning he had meant us to live it. The word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. What struck you in that reading?
I think just how succinctly he says, because it is by grace that you have been saved, through faith, not by anything of your own, but by a gift from God, and not by anything that you have done. And I think that really just clarifies that kind of argument about works or faith alone what is it that saves? And the answer is, well, it's God that saves. It's not us that save ourselves through either faith or through works. I suppose that, you know, takes the pressure off in some senses, but also just places it in a completely different perspective. You know, you're not the acting agent in your own salvation. Yeah.
I think that is quite astonishing, given that the popular culture understanding of religion is that if you do good, you go to heaven. If you do bad, you go to hell. And actually, incredibly often, as soon as I bring up theology in certain contexts where it's something really unfamiliar to people, the first question is, do you believe that if you're bad, you go to hell? Or quite often it's, do you think I'm going to hell?
Mm.
I guess that's kind of the association people have with it, is that that's what it's about, which is, and this is, as you say, it's saying the exact opposite, that it's not about do good, go to heaven, do bad, go to hell at all.
It's funny how often that does come up as a question. You go, well, you know, who am I to say? I don't know whether you're going to hell or not.
Yeah, I suppose, though, it's interesting that's a preoccupation of people, that I suppose their concern is that there's someone out there making judgment on them.
Which there is, but it's not you.
Yeah. The moment, obviously, that struck a chord in my ear as we were reading it is, we are God's work of art, created in Christ Jesus to live the good life, as from the beginning he had meant us to live it. I love that, but also it obviously resonates with what we're talking about today. I think we mentioned last week that David Jones says that all humans are artists, and his thinking there is that we are in the image of God, and God is the great artist, the creator.
Should we go on to in parenthesis, and then we can connect it into God's work of art?
Yeah.
Because it's interesting, the part that we're going to read in parenthesis is when he is very much in the trenches And it seems like the whole of the writing seems to be showing up how wrong it is for creation to be put into that position. It's the starkness of war and what that does to people and just how alien it is and should be.
Yeah, and actually, I was just looking at the one last bit from that reading that I just suddenly caught my eye as I was looking over it, is the bit where it says, how infinitely rich he is in grace. And I was thinking about how that for me feels like the way that David Jones saw the world.
Mm.
That he fought against the repercussions of being part of this horrifying and deeply traumatic war for his whole life. And yet he somehow managed to see that the gift of creation being something wonderful in such fine detail. You know, you feel sometimes like when you're reading Jones, you're looking through the eyes of someone who has like a power to magnify detail like 20 times what your own eyes can do. Yeah, so that's just another connection with the reading. And I think also from what you said, that sense that he's at the kind of anti-creation, I definitely think that's a large part what's being explored in In Parenthesis. One of the best David Jones scholars, or most prolific, is Thomas Dilworth, who wrote the biography of David Jones. And he wrote about the way that Jones references liturgies in the way that he talks about soldiers. He sort of sees a connection between life in the military and life kind of in the church, you know, because there are these collective practices. There are these ways that, you know, if you're in the military, there's like, say, for example, the hierarchy of ranks. And in the church, there's a hierarchy of ranks, there's Pope, Cardinal, Bishop. In the army, there are words that you just get used to saying over and over again. That repetition of orders in the army is very like the repetition of prayers in a church, especially when there's a kind of hard or strong liturgy. So where there's a lot of repetition of the same form of words. So he's making those connections. And Thomas Dilworth argues that those connections really lead to a kind of grand symbolic point being made in the whole poem, which is that what happens on the battlefield is the antithesis of what happens at the altar in the church. So it's the opposite of communion. The communion is the creative act of drawing community together in eternal life-givingness. And a no man's land is like the sort of the flat table of the altar, but the sacrifices, you know, are of people's lives, and it's a great undoing and it's a great splitting into parts. It's a great division that, I mean, okay, this is the sort of real pinnacle of the example, that the bread and the wine in the communion are transformed into something deeper than they are on their own, something with not just a material presence, but with the presence of God in them. They become representative of God, but he doesn't mean as in like they're just a kind of symbol of God, as in they literally make God present. Again, when a soldier dies on the battlefield, their body does the opposite. It loses the spiritual and the eternal and becomes just material and representative of nothing. It just becomes a thing. So it kind of goes down the hierarchy of being. It goes from being human to being not even animal, just matter.
And also being literally body and blood.
Yeah, yeah. So he sees it as a kind of undoing, yeah. Do you mind if I just read a tiny bit from the preface? Because I think it kind of helps to get into that a little bit as well. That that sense that Jones knows that that's the place that he's trying to forge poetry out of, that a kind of hell, and yet he's still trying to be as attentive as he can to the gifts, the infinite riches of grace and the gifts of God. Maybe I'll just read this bit. He said, "I did not intend this as a war book. It happens to be concerned with war. I should prefer it to be about a good kind of peace. But as Mandeville says, of paradise, nay, can I not speak improperly? I was not there. It is far beyond, and that far thinketh me. And also I was not worthy. We find ourselves privates in foot regiments. We search how we may see formal goodness in a life singularly inimical, hateful to us." And I think that just the combination of two things there, that the fact that he says he'd rather be writing about peace and he reluctantly writes about war because it's all he knows. And that quote from Mandeville that says, "I can't speak of paradise because I haven't seen it." And also, I'm not worthy to speak of it. And those are the kind of two things that Jones is presenting. But also, he says that last bit as well. We search how we may see formal goodness in a life singularly inimical and hateful to us. You know, that this is someone who doesn't give up on searching for goodness, even when it feels like he's just in a life that's hateful. And that's, I always found that a really powerful line in that preface. And I think that that goes a long way in helping to kind of understand what he's doing with his poetry. Did you want to say anything else about it before we read it, or should we have a read?
I think let's have a read.
Oh, let me just say one more thing.
Go on.
Because that's quite heavy to load on this text before we go into it. I just also want to say that Jones, this is one of the magic, just absolutely magical things about Jones, is that he manages to say that completely candidly with real seriousness and humility. And yet he also has a really cheeky sense of humor. And sometimes it's humor, sometimes it's just that sort of cheekiness or a sense of pushing boundaries a little bit, being a bit mischievous. And one of the things he says, I won't read the whole thing, but in the preface, just before that bit I read, is I have been hampered by the convention of not using impious and polite words. He's quite annoyed about the fact that he can't use a lot of swearing in this because, you know, it's the conventions of publishing, because in the army that's just a constant, right? That's part of the rhythm and the kind of the true texture of people's voices and their language. And then he just explains why he would have liked to have done it, and he says the very repetition of them made them seem liturgical, certainly deprived of malice, and occasionally, when skillfully disposed and used according to established but flexible tradition, gave a kind of significance and even moments of dignity to our speech. Sometimes their juxtaposition in a sentence, and when expressed under poignant circumstances, reached real poetry. Because of publication, it has been necessary to consider conventional susceptibilities. Some such expressions have nevertheless, of necessity, become part of the form this writing has taken. And as we'll explain, there's one sort of hidden away in the bit that we're going to read. Quite obviously, they do not constitute blasphemy in any theological sense, and that is all I would consider. Private X's tirade of oaths means no more than, I do not like this veil of tears. Whereas Flossie's, oh bother, would waste a countryside had she an efficacious formula. I say more, the bugger bugger of a man detailed had often about it the fiat fiat of the saints. Which I think is also another really telling and like helpful part of the preface to kind of invite us into the poetry.
Great.
Great, let's go in. So the kind of overview of the poem, because it's basically it's about 180 pages. It's a long poem and it's a story really. And to give a really quick summary of it, soldiers are leaving their camp in England to go off to join World War One in France. That's where it starts. And then it basically just follows their journey, and particularly the journey of one private foot soldier called John Ball. It follows him and his regiment through arrival in France, journeying towards the front line, being on the front lines, and eventually coming to it all coming to a head at the Battle of Mametz Wood, which is part of the Battle of the Somme. And it's basically it, you get mostly John Ball's perspective, or you know, a sense of watching John Ball, what's happening to John Ball as he goes along. But you do dip into other perspectives. You hear lots of other voices. And it's a London Welsh regiment. So it's got a mixture of Cockneys and Welshmen in it. And please, any Welsh people listening, you just really, I really, you really have to forgive me for this attempt at a Welsh accent.
So, this is my version of a synopsis of what's happening in David Jones's this little passage from in parentheses. John Ball is on night duty. Night duty, cold, dark, hungry. Trenches, a Celtic mythology, are hell. The devil and war are synonymous. He finds himself there, caught up in it, like the stuff of legends, but so much worse in reality. Sees the older man, who's 62, said he was 45 for recruitment. Now wishes he had not. They sing a football song of calamity, tins, saucepans, around a small fire. It is so cold. F, efficacious word. Prepare rifle. Remember Scott's instructor who bellowed at you as you learnt about the rifle shooting. Disembodied, you hear the sound. Erratic ricochet. Stillness. Such stillness. Dead calm. Rats. The rat has the run of this place, is master in this war. The birds of earlier battles have become rats. Such is the flavour of it. Sap, sap, sap. Scrut, scrut, scrut. Noticing how your body fits into the mud, the trench, he falls asleep and is woken with a start.
Great. So that's what you've got coming for you. Now let's get to David
Jones's version of it.
Jones's version.
So this is from the end of part three of In Parentheses. It's quite a long extract, so sit back, tune in, we'll have a go.
Can you see anything, Sentry?
Nothing, Corporal.
0-1 ball, is it, no?
Yes, Corporal.
Keep a sharp lookout, Sentry. 'Tis the most elementary disciplines. Sights at 350.
Yes, Corporal.
300, perhaps.
Yes, Corporal.
Starving as brass monkeys, as the Arctic bears asked you all. Starved as Penang Govid on the confines of hell.
Unwise it is to disturb the sentinel. Do dogs of Anwin glast this starving air? Do they ride the trajectory zone between the tangled break above the leaning walls?
This seventh gate is parked tonight.
His lamps hang in this black cold, and hang so still, with this still rain slow-moving vapours reeve to reflect their clear ray. Like through glassy walls that slowly turn, they rise and fracture. For this fog smoke wraith, they cast a dismal sheen. What does he brew in his cauldron over there? What is it like? Does he watch the Dixie Rim? Does he watch the Watcher? Does he stir his cup? He blesses no coward's stir over there. Does he watch for the 300 sleeping, or bent to their night tasks under the wall? In the complex galleries, his organization in depth holds many sleeping, well watched for sleepers under the night flares.
Old Adams, Usk, sits stark. He already regrets his 62 years. His rifle butt is a third foot for him. All three supports are wood for him. So chill this floor strikes up. So this chill creeps to mock his bogus listing age.
45, Christ. 45 in her jubilee year, before the mothers of these pups had dugs to nourish them.
He grips more tightly the cold band of his sling swivel. He'd known more sudden, darker ways, below the old working. He shifts his failing flanks along the clammy slats. He settles next his lance jack. He joins that muted song. Together they sing low of the little cauldron. Together they commemorate Johnny Ba.
You draw out warm fingertips, your split knuckles fumbling, foul some keen, chill-edged jack-spike jucking. You could weep like a child. You employ the efficacious word to ease frustration, to be rid of last back-breaking straws. At 350, slid up the exact steel, the graduated rigid leaf precisely angled to its bed. You remember the word of the staff instructor, whose kinross teeth barred, his bonnet awry, his broad bellow to make you spring to it, to pass you out with the 63 parts properly differentiated. You gradually increase the finger pressure toward and upward. The hollow places and the upright things give back their mimicry, each waking other shocked far out. Short before his parapet, disturbed wire tangs oddly for the erratic ricochet. You draw back the bolt. You feel the empty, hollow lob light against your boot lacing. You hear the infinitesimal disturbance of water in the trench drain. And the deepened stillness as a calm cast over us. A potent influence over us and him. Dead calm for this Sargasso dank and for the creeping things. You can hear the silence of it. You can hear the rat of no man's land rut out intricacies, weasel out his patient workings, scrut, scrut, scrut. Harrow out earthly, trowel his cunning paw, redeem the time of our uncharity to sap his own amphibious paradise. You can hear his carrying parties rustle our corruptions through the night weeds, contest the choicest morsels in his tiny conduits, bead-eyed feast on us, by a rule of his nature, at night feast on the broken of us. Those broad pinions, blue-burnished or brinded back, whose proud eyes watched the broken emblems droop and drag dust, suffer us with this metamorphosis. These too have shed their fine feathers. These too have slimed their dark, bright coats. These too have condescended to dig in. The white-tailed eagle at the battle ebb, where the sea wars against the river, the speckled kite of Maldon and the crow have naturally selected to be unwinged, to go on the belly, to sap, sap, sap. With festered spines, arched under the moon, ferret with whiskered snouts the secret parts of us. When it's all quiet, you can hear them. Scrut, scrut, scrut. When it's as quiet as this is, it's so very still. Your body fits the crevice of the bay in the most comfortable fashion imaginable. It's cushy enough.
The relief elbows him on the fire step.
All quiet, China. Bugger all to report. Kipping, mate. Christ, mate, you'll have them all over.
So it's not, it's not at all easy to understand this poetry. I say that because somebody might be listening thinking, oh, what on earth was that all about? I don't know what was going on. Which is absolutely my first experience of reading the poetry, Jones's poetry. I mean, like, that didn't stop me loving it for some reason. I don't know why, but I read his poetry for the first time many years ago, didn't understand a word of it and knew that I loved it. I don't know how. I mean, I guess it's just the sound of it. Because you can hear things in it, even if you don't understand it, I suppose. It's like listening to, if you ever listened to a poem in another language or a song in another language, and you go, I don't know what's being said here, but I can appreciate the way that those sounds sound together. They sound really delicious and crunchy or something like that, or whatever it is, you know. And I think there are moments like that. Your split knuckles fumbling foul, some keen chill edge, jack spike jutting. A sentence like that, you know, it's going to take about seven times of saying it or reading it before you really know what it means, but you can still hear the onomatopoeia in it, the way that it, the sound of it represents in some way what it means. And that particular sentence, by the way, that I just read is when John Ball, who's been put on sentry duty to look out over no man's land, hits his knuckles against some kind of something sticking out the wall of the trench, something sharp. Foul, some keen, chill-edged, jack spike jutting. They knock against something keen, chill-edged, sharp, basically, spiky in the dark. So that's, anyway, I would just say that to reassure anybody who's feeling like they didn't get what was going on.
So, Kate, are you going to go through word by word and explain to us what's happening? Or
that would take us about seven episodes.
If you can just pick out a few key bits that you feel are really important that we know what's going on in them.
Okay, well, what I'll do is I'll go through it as, you know, chronologically, just look down and see what I can explain. I mean, so the first bit is just a conversation between the private and his corporal about being on sentry and how cold it is. I mean, there's also references in that early bit, in that conversation, starved as Pentland Govid, and do the dogs of Anorn Glass the starving air. And on both of those, Jones has a sort of a note attached to it. And it's basically to reference, as Antonia said at the beginning, a kind of Celtic hell, basically, Celtic mythological hell. Starving as brass monkeys is just, he says, popular expression among the soldiers, enough to freeze the testicles off a brass monkey. and Tiol is just a Welsh expletive meaning devil.
Why do you think he's doing this, like making this three-layer connection of trenches, Celtic mythology, Celtic hell?
Yeah. Well, I think that it's not a coincidence that it comes out during the conversation between these two different soldiers. Jones, so he himself was from London and experienced the war alongside Welshmen as well. He was part of a Welsh regiment. So he encountered kind of Welsh soldiers as almost like having a foreign culture, but one that he knew about, being partly Welsh himself as well. That he said that even in their kind of everyday conversation, the way they spoke, you could hear references to that mythology, that profounder culture. And it doesn't matter whether they knew about it or not, whether they were educated in it. It wasn't purposeful. It was just sewn into the way that they spoke. And the same with these Cockneys that he was with. That they were, the way they spoke, okay, it was it had poetry in it because of the rhythm and the kind of phrases they had and things like that. But it also wove into it stories and folk mythology and things that kind of just can't come through. So it's part of the way he writes in his own poetry, is that these things just work up through the soil of people's language.
All the words have roots.
Yeah, and all the phrases and the ways that we speak. And so though he's kind of, I guess he's just giving them a slightly a helping hand to the surface. But they are there anyway, or that's how what he sees, is that those mythologies are in the ways that we talk to each other, the ways that we see, the way that one person comes to a dark night on the edge of no man's land, looking over the trenches where it's freezing cold. And the things that will be referenced for them in their mind will be different depending on your cultural influences. I said something to someone the other day. It was on a place where a group of mothers that Antonia and I know share writing together. And I wrote something about a night spent next to a sick baby. And someone said something like, I felt like you were in Middle Earth or...
Fighting the Balrog.
Oh, that's it. Fighting the Balrog.
Fighting the Balrog, and the Balrog was the baby.
Right, yeah. And that was a cultural reference that just came to that person's mind, right? So it's like, how do they encounter this experience that is felt all around the world and has been felt for millennia? For us, in our particular cultural reference, we can go to Middle Earth, the Balrog. And the same thing Jones is highlighting is happening for these soldiers. One person comes to this cold air and they think of, he hasn't got this in here, but let's say they think of Valhallen. And another person comes and they think of Penangofid, which is what he's got in here, which is the Celtic underworld. The Welsh called the chill Caledonian wastes beyond the wall, the wild land of hell. So for this particular Welshman, that's what his reference is for this experience. So that's one of the things that makes it so hard, is because Jones is just pushing those slightly more to the surface of the language than they might be. And they are cultural differences. They might not be your cultural reference points, which makes it hard for you to then follow the line of thought.
I want to ask two things. Yeah. One's about the efficacious word, and one's about the sticking together of different words, like the noun, adjective, verb combination things, and what's going on with his particular style of language with that.
Well, why don't you tell us about the efficacious word?
Well, from what I understand, efficacious words are words that perform an action in their saying of them. They're words that do something. And so you've got this nice little combination here of the efficacious word being a particular swear word, sounding slightly like actually what efficacious sounds like. And he is employing that word to ease frustration, and that the speaking of that word does actually ease the frustration of whacking his hand against this sharp thing in the night. And then I think that the parallel of that is that there are efficacious words at Mass where the priest, in saying the words, actually performs the act of turning the bread and wine into body and blood, that those words do that. So you've got this liturgical swearing going on.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's what I mentioned earlier in the preface. Someone that influenced Jones a lot, Maurice de la Taille, who was a Jesuit, wrote about this and said that when a ranking of an officer, for example, in the army is given, someone will say, you are corporal. And the saying of it is does what it signifies. The words affect the act. So here he's got this term, efficacious word, which is used by Maurice de la Taille to explain the liturgy. And it's being used as a replacement for the word. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that one. Then you said the other thing was this thing of putting words together.
So like with the broad pinioned, blue burnished, brinded back.
The first thing to say about that is, if you're going to find the influence of Gerard Manley Hopkins anywhere in Jones, it's in this moment, isn't it?
I was just about to say that.
And that's partly because of the sort of the sound of it. Broad pinioned, blue burnished, brinded back. Sounds like Hyde Beauty. Glory be to God for dapple things, for skies of couple colour as a brinded cow. For rose moles all in stipple upon trout that swim fresh fire coal, chestnut falls, finches wings, So, I mean, you can hear in that those first lines, the dappled things and the brinded cow. Maybe it was just the word brinded that brought that poem to mind, but it's also the way that, Hopkins is really bold with the creation of neologism, words that he combines, bringing two words together. Chestnut falls, he makes into one word in that poem. And similarly here, Jones makes blue burnished, brinded back, two words into one word. Brinded, adjective, back, noun. He combines the adjective and the noun to make a descriptive noun.
What does it mean? What's he describing?
Brinded, having grey or brown streak or pattern or patchy colouring. So in this whole passage, he's describing, first of all, just the rats. You can hear the rats in no man's land. They're eating the choicest morsels. Bead-eyed, they feast on us like carrion crows. You know, they're kind of like carrion animals or like vultures. They're waiting for your body to become food for them. But also, it literally is, they are eating the dead soldiers. It's the kind of horror of it there as well. Then those broad pinion, blue burnished or brinded back is the description of the different kinds of different patterned rats, different kinds of rats. And then he starts to compare them to other creatures that have been on the battlefield in the past. Broad pinioned means broad winged.
Mm.
It says they suffer with us this metamorphosis to have shed their fine feathers. So he's then starting to imagine them as the great birds of the battlefield, like the kite of Maldon or eagles. You know, the things people have on top of their banners in ancient battles. They would have these birds of battle, birds of prey at the battlefield. And he's sort of suggesting that the rats are these birds diminished to this sub, sort of undignified.
Amphibious paradise.
Yeah, this kind of horror version of ancient battles. As it says, these two have slimed their dark bright coats. These two have condescended to dig in.
I think two things. One is, like, often the words are opposites that he sticks together. So, for instance, the dead calm, dark bright coats. And so you get this kind of unease created in these new words because they jar. Because if you're... It's just interesting how he's describing the war and the kind of words that he's going for in comparison to, say, other war poets who are, I suppose, in a massively generalised sense, either playing off old forms and trying to do a Tennyson but failing because the war is so much more horrible, or going quite directly with what's happening, like a sort of lamentation, a wailing. And Jones doesn't seem to be doing either. He's almost just trying to observe really minutely what the reality of this situation is and carrying into it the whole of his being as a meaning maker, and I guess trying to make meaning in this situation. And so then it feels like these new words created are created in some way out of necessity to capture or meaning make in that scenario, because there's something about saying things as they are in a kind of familiar way that would make us pass over them, would make us think, oh yeah, I can imagine that I can imagine that easily, and I can almost imagine it without the horror of it. And his words sort of trip you up into actually having to dig into their full rooted sense. So this bead-eyed feast on us, and that feasting being literally rats feasting on dead bodies, and feasting as in viewing with desire. Just that transmogrification, like the transformation of both into sub what they are. And I think the words create the contours of that. I mean, even just this bit, the broken emblems droop and drag dust, suffer with us this metamorphosis. These two have shed their fine feathers. These two have slimed in their dark bright coats. These two have condescended to dig in. And all of these things, that this is what the people are doing too. They're broken emblems, they're drooping and they're dragging dust as they go across. And they are slimed and their dark, bright coats. So again, this is like the contradictory words, dark and bright, dark, bright coats.
Mm.
I don't know. There's this question about, well, you could just say, well, it is ugly. You know, this the war, it just is ugly. And you wouldn't be wrong to stop there at that point and go, this is ugliness. This is a definition of that.
Yeah.
But he seems to be trying to redeem it or allow for grace in it.
Yeah. I was just thinking about the fact that what you were just describing about their dark, bright coats, these two have slimed their dark, bright coats, just reminded me that David Jones was really fascinated with Coleridge's Rime of the Ancient Mariner and wrote about the way that in the middle of the poem, the mariner is out on this boat. The crew have all died and he's just him alone starving and thirsting on this boat. And he looks around and in the moonlight, he sees a thousand slimy things, which is the snakes, the water snakes. Sort of.
Mm.
There's a sense of this profound ugliness of them, horrifying, image of the water kind of rippling with these slimy things. And then in the next moment, the mariner suddenly sees that it could be quite beautiful in the moonlight, as the moonlight catches their backs. And for Jones, analyzing that poem, he saw that that was the moment at which the mariner's fate changes. The moment that he's able to bless these other creatures is the moment that he basically receives grace in the poem. A spring of love gushed from my heart. That's the bit I'm thinking about. And when the mariner says that, that's when his fortunes change. And I feel like there's something like that going on in for Jones, that became a symbol of what the artist is doing, looking and looking and looking at the ugliness and waiting for that spring of love to gush from your heart, to be able to suddenly see it in the moonlight and go, there is still something beautiful here that I can capture.
Mm.
He calls it the crux of the poem. I mean, you said earlier about comparing with other war poets. I'm thinking about Charles Hamilton Sawley is a war poet, and his poems are devastating. And, you know, the message within them is, don't try and turn this into something good. There is no goodness here. All goodness is gone. And if you try, it's only because you weren't there.
Mm-mm-mm.
And you can't, as someone reading a poem by a soldier in a war who says that, you can't say otherwise. It's not for you to say otherwise. But Jones, that's why I think Jones is remarkable in many ways, because he suffered the war. He's the longest serving, if we want to call him a war poet, and he was a private soldier. So think about Wilfred Owen, Siegfried Sassoon. These were officers. They're in a slightly, not that they didn't suffer it as well, of course they did, but they were in a slightly different ranking and class. Jones was just among all the private soldiers who were just thrown, you know, into the Battle of the Somme ruthlessly, and bodies never recovered, and all the rest of everything we know about it. And yet he still tries to present the things that are life-giving in the war. Having said that, just one other little bit from the preface is that he says in the preface, I had to write it. The first thing he says actually in the preface is, the period covered begins early in December 1915 and ends early in July 1916. The wholesale slaughter of the later years, the conscripted levies filling the gaps in every file of four, knocked the bottom out of the intimate, continuing domestic life of small contingents of men, within whose structure Roland could find and for a reasonable while enjoy his Oliver. And he says, sorry, before I missed out a bit there, where he says, after July 1916,
mm-mm-mm.
From then onwards, things hardened into a more relentless mechanical affair and took on a more sinister aspect. So he has still limited himself to saying, it was only that portion of the war that he experienced where he could do this. And specifically because part of what In Parenthesis is built on as a poem is the relationship between men who are living together in these conditions.
Mm.
But as he says, after 1916, the rapidity with which people were killed and replaced, it was so rapid that you couldn't maintain those kind of connections with people.
This might be a good point to introduce some music.
I thought we'd listen to a Gaelic psalm singing from the Isle of Lewis. This is a very old form of singing. You have something like a kind of call and response or cantor and choir. The cantor will sing a line of a psalm, improvising a tune, I mean, around a kind of a mode that is familiar to people in the church. And then collectively, they will improvise the singing of the psalm. And it's like the vocal equivalent of a murmuration of starlings. They kind of somehow move to the same notes together, and it creates this incredible and beautiful sort of sliding sound.
Great. Shall we try and link ourselves back to bunches of flowers?
Yeah, or flowers just, flowers generally, why not?
Yeah. You said that there was a way of linking flowers to Jones and back to the Atari Sunday.
Well, just that in the last part of this poem, so this is an encouragement for you to read the whole thing through. By the end of it, you get to this beautiful, beautiful, maybe it's not the right word, but maybe it is. It feels hard to say beautiful, but anyway, that's another discussion. This moment at the end of the Battle of Commandments Wood, with all these soldiers lying dead in the woods, and the Queen of the Woods comes and gives them each their own flowers, with the sense of, you know, the Ophelia in Hamlet, here's Rue, what's Rue
for? For remembrance.
You've performed Ophelia, haven't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, so almost with that sort of same rhythm, you get
The queen of the woods has cut boughs of various flowering. Some she gives white berries, some she gives brown. Emile has a curious crown, it's made of golden saxifrage. Fatty wears sweet briar. He will reign with her for a thousand years. For Balder she reaches high to fetch his. Ulrich smiles for his myrtle wand. That's why Lily White has daisies on his chain. You'd hardly credit it. She plats talks of equal splendour for Mr. Jenkins and Billy Cowell. Hansel and Grownie share dog violets for a palm, where they lie in serious embrace beneath the twisted tripod.
Yeah, thank you. That's exactly it. I suppose each person there in that moment is given that sense of individual blessing, that she's specifically chosen these particular parts of creation to represent them, to signify them, or to signify the blessing of them. And you just imagine this landscape strewn with dead bodies and the horror of it, and the contrast of that with the daisies and the rowan sprig.
Yeah, and then the connection of the naming each one of them. They each have their name, and then given the particular flower that symbolises the particular thing for each of them. It's like after a massacre of anonymity, each of them in death receives their dignity again in some sense. It's so devastating, isn't it? This Hansel and Grownie share dog violets for a palm where they lie in serious embrace beneath the twisted tripod.
Yeah. Also, it's the particular thing of that the flowers having an essentially female, so symbolic nature, which obviously now jars a lot against a lot of sensibilities because we're less inclined to determine things for one gender or another. But I think we can at least recognise that historically, culturally, flowers have had this great femininity, and that it's that introducing of femininity in the place which is totally masculine, or you know, dominated by men. And I think there's no accident as well that in the church Mary has often been associated with flowers. We've spoken about this, I think, a little bit before, but the number of flowers that have Mary associated with them. I was talking to Moroccan, and he said that rosemary in Moroccan is Lala Miriam, and Miriam is the mother of Jesus, Mary. So even in Morocco, it's also associated with Mary. That's a sort of tenuous tie. Well, it's not that. I mean, we could go deeper and find a stronger links there, but I think that tie of that feminine force coming into the end of in parenthesis with the bestowing of flowers. Tell me though about, you've got a question, but I just noticed it. You've had a question in our notes that I hadn't seen before, which was, are you a bright colours flowers person in the garden, or you said green flowers as the alternative? Or
yeah,
green,
obviously those are the only two options.
Yeah. So what do you go for?
Well, I particularly like blossom, and the time of blossom, and the fleetingness of blossom, and the snow-likeness. So I'm not actually a very bright coloured flower person. I think I'm more functional flowers, i.e. ones you can eat, so herbs that happen to have flowers. I remember once coming to your garden and you'd got some extremely loud marigolds and a sunflower, and that was it. The rest of it was just completely barren.
Was that in Clapham?
Yeah, it was in Clapham.
I was not head gardener in Clapham, but I do remember that was when I got converted to sunflowers. Because sunflowers, they are like the golden retriever of flowers, that they just are like, yeah, we're going to be happy. Whoa, sun! And you're like, yeah, but what about the tortures of life? And like, nah, sunny. It's sunny, isn't it? It's sunny. Yeah, so that's why I like sunflowers. But also, my grandma was a flower farmer. Yeah, so she used to sell flowers at market. They'd converted a dairy farm into a flower farm when EU quotas came in the 80s, actually, and prevented them making small-scale dairy farming possible. Anyway, so it became a flower farm, and she became an expert in silver foliage. So the whole garden was basically silver foliage, and then you'd get the odd bright flower here or there, the odd foxglove creeping over the top. And I remember thinking that that's quite a powerful combination. If you have a garden that is 80% silver foliage, the focus is on shape and form. And that's really striking. You know, it's almost like what happens when it snows and suddenly the whole landscape just becomes about form. I know that Father Dermot, our good friend, who's just turned 60. Well done, Father Dermot.
Woohoo!
His favourite plant, I think I'm right in saying, in the garden is his hostas.
I was going to say that too. So either we've both got it wrong or we know the answer.
I'm glad I've got backup from you on that. And those, it's the sculpture and the form of it, really, isn't it? Which is not a flower, if you want to look up a hosta. Well, it does have a flower, but it's really planted for the leaf.
But somehow he manages to get his not eaten by slugs, but in every other situation I've ever seen a hosta, it's been mullered.
Yeah.
I think that's enough for today, isn't it?
Yeah, Thank you for listening.
Come again.
Come again soon. Help yourself to anything from the minibar on the way out.
Bye.
Reading Flannery O'Connor with a pencil and a pen. This song is like a rain cloud that keeps circling overhead. And there it comes around again.
This was a Radio Maria podcast. If you enjoyed it, do please click like and subscribe on your podcast provider or leave us a review. Every bit of feedback helps increase our visibility and allows us to reach more people with the message of Christ's saving truth. And if you don't already, you can listen to Radio Maria live either online or on DAB in selected regions of the UK. We'd love for you to call in live and be part of the conversation. See our website, radiomariaengland.uk, for more details and a full schedule of programmes. And do please consider making a donation so that we can keep making more programmes like this. We are completely dependent upon the generosity of our listeners.